I'd like to start with a little national context to give us some background. The eugenics movement's influence in America is difficult to summarize numerically since it was such a diverse phenomenon with many localized components. Though insufficient as a metric by themselves, marriage laws can provide one way to measure the extent of eugenic thought in America. By the mid-1920s, 28 states had passed legislation outlawing interracial marriages. By mid-1930s, 41 states had passed laws to prevent the marriage of feeble-minded or insane persons, while 17 states had laws forbidding the marriage of epileptics. Sterilization serves as another indicator. The first U.S. sterilization law passed in Indiana in 1907. By 1931, 30 states had passed such legislation. By the end of the 1960s, according to Edward Larson and Philip Riley, American state governments had sterilized over 60,000 persons, often without their consent or without their knowledge. Most states repealed their sterilization laws by the mid-1970s, though notably North Carolina repealed one law to substitute it with another law, only repealed in October 2003, and had sterilized individuals as late as 2002. Eugenics is a rather complex term that covers a movement or movements that were socially powerful even as they might be contradictory. Wendy Klein suggests that eugenics in the U.S. should be understood as a countrywide crusade to strengthen family and civilization by regulating fertility between 1900 and 1960. In the late 19th century, the white middle class in the United States was moving from self-employment to corporate work. White middle class members responded to this destabilization in interesting ways as they were deeply anxious about this loss of independence. But at the same time, they often embraced some version of the efficiency-oriented corporate model that displaced their own farms and businesses. This, coupled with widespread labor unrest, urbanization, and changing demographics that seemed to indicate that the working classes, immigrants, and African Americans were more vital, more reproductively fecund than the middle class, created deep middle class anxieties in the early 20th century. Linking this to changing gender roles of the early 20th century problematized this. The rise of the new women, rise of female autonomy, seemed to pose a threat to the traditional home. These conditions laid the groundwork for an ideology that promised to revive the uncertain future of the white middle class, restore its leadership role in society. Eugenics served as one of those ideologies. It linked dreams of national salvation to the rising corporate economic model and promised a role for the white bourgeois men and women to become surrogate parents to the nation. Politically, eugenics had influence at the highest levels. According to Ronald Carson and Mark Rothstein, every president from Theodore Roosevelt to Herbert Hoover was a member of a eugenics organization, publicly endorsed eugenic laws, or signed eugenic legislation without voicing opposition. Economically, eugenic organizations enjoyed support from such powerful forces as the Harriman Fortune, the Carnegie Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation. In spite of all this, in the United States, eugenics is primarily a decentralized and dispersed movement. While it clearly had national and international leaders, national and international books and journals, its real energy came from the grassroots. The engines of dispersal were pamphlets published by small and local publishers, countless lectures in churches, YMCAs, women's organizations, radio programs, and classrooms, where eugenics would be taught to captive audiences from high schoolers to medical students to college freshmen. The legislative high point for eugenics in the state of Minnesota was the 1925 passage of the Eugenic Sterilization Act. At the state level in Minnesota, many prominent Minnesotans were members of eugenic societies or outspoken subscribers to eugenic theories. These included Governor John Lind, Minneapolis Mayor William Eustace, the Episcopalian rector of St. Mark's Church, Reverend Philip Osgood, and Walter List, the superintendent of the Minneapolis General Hospital. Many University of Minnesota administrators endorsed the Minnesota Eugenics Society, including Ada Comstock, the university's first dean of women and later president of Radcliffe, who said that, quote, "Eugenics is the greatest concern of the human race." President Lotus Kaufman also, who wrote, "It is my opinion that the great hope for the race lies in the intensive study of eugenics applied to human families." President William Falwell was involved in the foundation of the Minnesota Eugenics Society as in well. While Charles Fremont Dyte is the figure most associated with the local movement, today I want to look at a variety of individuals who give a fuller portrait to the movement and its connections to the University of Minnesota. I focus on these six individuals not because they were the only six eugenicists in the state, but rather because each of these figures demonstrates important aspects of eugenic thought that was prevalent throughout the state, the nation, and the university. They were primarily white, American-born, and by and large from small towns where they were from good families. They were generally well-intentioned and sought to do good and serve their community and nation. They were all extremely successful in their fields. They were educators and administrators who sought to do the best they could, no different in intent from such individuals today. Their failings were more due to limitations inscribed by their relative privilege. A parochial vision of the nation, a fixation on purity over plurality, a racially exclusive ideology of citizenship, a commitment to the idea of hereditary human hierarchy, and a tendency to seek the easy technological fix. For each of these men that I'm going to outline today, I'll give you a brief bio of who they were, and then connect them to their role in the eugenics movement in the university, the state, and the nation. I want to start with Henry Nachtribe. Professor Nachtribe was at the University of Minnesota for a good part of its formative years, first as a student and then as faculty. This is his 1882 graduation picture. Henry Fairchild Nachtribe is the center here. He played a significant role in the university's shape and helped to consolidate its power both socially and fiscally. He performed a similar service for the eugenics movement in Minnesota. He was an early convert to eugenics and was involved in national eugenics organizations. While at the university, he was instrumental in getting eugenics into the university curriculum. A look at Nachtribe's life shows the way that the university began to exert and expand its influence in the state and the ways in which eugenics was intimately linked to that project and vice versa. Henry Nachtribe had a very long and distinguished career at the University of Minnesota and was recognized both locally and internationally for his scientific contributions and social service to the state and to the nation. He was born near Galton, Ohio in 1857. His father was a German immigrant and a minister. Nachtribe received his Bachelor's of Science from the University of Minnesota, 1882, specializing in the natural sciences, did his graduate work at Johns Hopkins in 1885, and became an assistant professor of biology at the University of Minnesota in 1886, was appointed head of the newly formed Department of Animal Biology here in 1887, and remained department head for 38 years until his retirement in 1925. The time of Nachtribe's tenure would see a great deal of change as the university transformed from a fledgling school on the prairie into a bustling research institution with a much larger mission and population. One of Nachtribe's most significant roles was as a founder and the first president of the General Alumni Association, founded in 1904, a position and organization that he used to great effect in lobbying the state political system for the benefit of the university. Nachtribe's position in the association placed him in correspondence with diverse social elements, from governors to state industrialists, Mayo Clinic directors, all the way to anonymous alumni complaining of losing the latest football game. Nachtribe was a football fanatic and kept a lively correspondence. Nachtribe used the bully pulpit provided by his work on behalf of the university and in the scientific community for his public eugenic advocacy. His introduction to public activism on human biological issues came in 1896 when he spoke on the child from a biologist's point of view for the Minnesota Child Study Association. His involvement with eugenics originated from yet another request for public service. Dr. A.C. Rogers, superintendent of the Minnesota School for the Feeble-Minded and Colony for Epileptics in Faribault, approached Nock Tribe in 1912 with a request that he join a committee for researching the biological roots of criminality. Here is a key aspect of eugenic thought that we can see over and over again: determining a biological cause for a social problem and then attempting to manage it on a biological basis. As part of that committee's investigation, Nock Tribe began corresponding with the leading national eugenics organizations and soon became a committed eugenic activist. He developed university courses in eugenics in 1912, and by 1913, he was delivering lectures such as, quote, "breeding human stock," end quote, on the radio, at the university, and around the state, using charts supplied by Dr. Rogers from Faribault. Nock Tribe was a founding member of the Minnesota Eugenics Society, was an associate member of H.H. Laughlin's and Charles Davenport's Eugenics Research Association, and served on the advisory council of the American Eugenics Society. When Nock Tribe taught eugenics at the university in the fall of 1917, he received course material from Laughlin himself, the forms entitled Record of Family Traits, quite similar to some of the forms you would see when you go to the Science Museum, were supplied in duplicate so that after the students had filled them out, one copy could be retained by the professor and the other copy could be sent off to the Eugenics Record Office and join the ever-growing data cache establishing human genetic norms in the United States. Additionally, Nock Tribe himself personally persuaded president of the university, Lotus Kaufman, to endorse the 1925 Sterilization Act. Nock Tribe's career shows the university and the eugenics movement in a pivotal moment. Both were just beginning to gain power and establish authority, and he was instrumental in securing funds, data, and facilities for both in Minnesota. His vigorous advocacy staked out a wide swath of territory, literal and figurative. He is later in his career on the right. For the university, his work linked the university's authority explicitly with the eugenic cause. His relationships with his colleagues and the remarkable homogeneity within their ranks indicate the close-knit nature of the national professional scientific community at that time. His attitudes show the promise and limitations of that scientific community's assumptions. One of Nock Tribe's frequent correspondents was another prominent Minnesota eugenicist and university professor, Willett Hayes, who, among other things, advised Nock Tribe on the appropriate type of radishes to grow in Minnesota. As a nationally known agronomist, Hayes represents the deep ties that the eugenics movement had with agriculture, both actually and rhetorically. The tight connections among the land-grant university system, agricultural higher education, and the origins of the American eugenics movement. Willett Martin Hayes was born on an Iowa farm to a Pennsylvania German mother and a father whose relatively prosperous farming family went back to early Anglo occupation. Hayes earned a Bachelor of Agriculture degree in 1885 and a Master's of Agriculture in 1887 from Iowa State University. He accepted a position at the University of Minnesota and taught from 1888 until his appointment as Assistant Secretary of Agriculture under the Roosevelt administration in 1904. He remained in government until Wilson's inauguration. Hayes was especially known for his practice of the scientific method in agriculture. His work focused on training young farmers to be in scientific principles, such as scientific observation, cause and effect, nature study, classification, and correlation. Hayes published on subjects ranging from rural engineering, soil physics, field and farm management, to forage crops, botany, and the breeding and cultivation of corn. He bred new varieties of wheat, flax, and corn for northern climes, and his class lectures on plant breeding were published by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Hayes was a passionate advocate of the small family farm, the value of which he based explicitly on eugenic foundations. According to Hayes, state and federal policy needed to be enacted to support smaller farms, not for the purpose of efficient agriculture in terms of crops or livestock, but rather for the efficient production of farmers as the stock population of a healthy nation. He wrote, "The larger public policy will best be served when the eugenic side of country life is fully appreciated. If the two-man farm plan will produce the greatest number of good citizens, will conduce to the production of the strongest country people, and will result in the largest measure of happiness to the sum of the people in the open country, means should be discovered not merely to preserve, but to highly develop country life under that plan. In this community, attention will come to be paid to the values of good heredity, and the community will doubtless come to look upon each farm home as an institution in which the public, the state, and the race is interested as the source of strong people." The conflation of agriculture with human society, as deployed here, was one of the most dominant tropes of the United States eugenics movement. It certainly permeates the writings of all the University of Minnesota eugenicists, who variously write of weeding the human garden, breeding human thoroughbreds, or raising, quote, the man crop. And it's almost invariably the man crop. The use of agricultural parallels to justify the necessity of human eugenics should not be surprising, considering the birthplace of eugenics in the U.S. context. The first national membership-based organization in this country that promoted eugenics and genetic research was the American Breeders Association, of which Willard Hayes and Charles Davenport were founders and prominent leaders. Hayes stressed a government-sponsored program of positive eugenics, arguing that morality and justice were best served when humans applied agricultural principles to their own procreation. To that end, advocacy of farming methods to better humanity was only part of Hayes' programs. Farms were also the home of the race. In other words, farms' highest purpose was literally to promote the breeding of what he saw as the nation's most efficient and most truly American population, rural farmers. Hayes wrote, "The open country has two main functions: the productions of raw food and clothing for the whole people, and the support of farm folks in such a substantial way as to induce the best of them to permanently live on the land, to have healthy and large families, that their virile blood may dominate the whole race." Thus, it was the farm that would provide a return of biological and moral purity to America, stemming what was perceived as a growing urban-generated decay of the national social fabric and national morality. I should mention, though, that non-white farmers don't appear in Hayes' data or his program, and subsistence farmers in the eastern United States were often portrayed as degenerate or ignorant. So the right kind of farmers, through their close relationship with the American landscape, and their assumed Anglo-Saxon or Northern European heritage, were the true Americans and could provide a path of salvation for the United States as a nation through their vitality and blood. By privileging the Midwestern farmer, eugenicists, such as those at the University of Minnesota, were declaring the Midwest to be the reservoir of traditional stock and the vehicle of national redemption. Such rhetoric appealed to a wide range of powerful Americans who saw in the middle of the country a cure for what they perceived as the blight of urban decay and eastern effeminacy. Even today, the myth of the American heartland percolates through various campaigns marketing everything from pickup trucks to U.S. presidents. Hayes' metaphors show how eugenic rhetoric depended on borrowings from already established discourses. Whether Hayes was applying the rigor of agricultural science to the hazier fields of human heredity and breeding, or calling upon popular and incorrect mythologies of Midwestern exceptionalism, he placed his ideas firmly within established realms of cultural common sense in order to craft authenticity for his analysis and to persuade his audience. While Minnesotans such as Hayes, Nock Tribe, and others used eugenics to justify their goals and means to a new future of national salvation or purity, that new engineered future looked very much like the mythology of the old vision of Republican virtue. As Robert Wiebe says, eugenics, for all its harsh qualities, drew upon a rich tradition of village values. In other words, Hayes and his fellows were striving to institute the mores of the town set within a simple yet scientific frame, a formidable combination. At the same time, Hayes' enshrinement of homogeneity and the managerial imperative seems slightly at odds with his idealization of an agricultural society with village values. This is one of the paradoxes at the heart of eugenic work. While endorsing the application of new scientific methods for social improvement, the goal of that improvement was to maintain and enforce perceived traditional social values. For Hayes, preserving the independent family farm would require the intervention of technologically complex networks of state-directed transportation, marketing, education, and in some cases, invasive surgery and physical manipulation. He did not recognize the fact that such monolithic intervention would violate the very independence that he sought to preserve. Next figure that I would like to take a look at is a man named Albert Ernest Jenks to move this policy forward. Albert Ernest Jenks demonstrates the link between national racial purity and the development of anthropology and eugenic ideology. Albert Ernest Jenks was born in Michigan, 1869, to a family that could trace its lineage back to the Mayflower. He earned two BS degrees, one from Kalamazoo College, the other from the University of Chicago, and completed his PhD at the University of Wisconsin in 1902. He was appointed assistant chief of the Bureau of Non-Christian Tribes in Manila. The next year, he was appointed to the chief of the Ethnological Survey for the Philippine Islands. Jenks came to the University of Minnesota in the fall of 1906. He initiated the university's first anthropology courses and founded its anthropology department. He remained chair of the anthropology here until his retirement in 1938. Jenks was also nationally respected and recognized. In 1923, for example, he was one of 100 men and women appointed by the Secretary of the Interior to assist the government in forming Indian policy. Also in 1923, he was elected chair of the National Research Council's Committee on Anthropology and Psychology. Jenks's classroom lectures incorporated physical anthropology and racialist eugenics, disseminating this ideological system to an entire generation of university students. The racialist foundation of Jenks's anthropology is obvious from a student's 1909 lecture notes. Jenks delineated the hierarchy of races in descending order from white to yellow to brown to red to black, and stressed that all cultural advancement was racially based, that the highest state of culture was enlightenment, which he described as the development of individualism specifically in America. As you can see from this chart designed by Jenks and used in classrooms around the United States through the 1950s, Jenks divided the white race from the rest of humanity and ranked ethnicities into a hierarchy in descending order from Nordic man, corresponding to the Iron Age and civilization, all the way over on the far right, to Mediterranean man, corresponding to the Bronze Age, to Alpine man, linked to the Neolithic or Stone Age. Jenks's eugenic publications demonstrate an overwhelming concern for purity, both racial and sexual and moral. Nordic, here is Iron, Bronze, Neolithic, Nordic, Mediterranean, Alpine. He agreed with a Minnesota Eugenics Society endorsement of legislation to support sterilization of the feeble-minded in the state. Unlike his fellows, however, he felt that sterilization of the feeble-minded was not sufficient to protect society from dangerous influences. Jenks argued for the continual social and sexual segregation of the feeble-minded from the rest of society, even after sterilization, that would protect future generations from the potential taint of polluted germplasm. Segregation, for Jenks, offered the only guarantee against moral contamination from sexually available defectives, particularly women. In response to the passage of the eugenic sterilization legislation in Minnesota, Jenks wrote this letter to Minnesota Eugenic Society President Charles Dite. To be effective, all subnormals should be sterilized, whether or not they approve, and none should be turned loose to destroy the character of other persons by sexual contact. I am confident this last point is important. Sex disease may be spread from such persons as readily as others, and since the potent fear of conception no longer has its hold on them, they are really more vicious to society morally, though not biologically, than before sterilization was effected. Here, Jenks links anxieties of race with anxieties of purity, revealing underlying concerns with boundary transgressions and fears of pollution, contamination, and contagion. In 1912, he had advocated the passage of an anti-miscegenation law in Minnesota, suggesting not just that it outlaw interracial marriage, but that the law should make any interracial sex act a felony. While Nachtribe, Hayes, and Jenks advocated eugenics through political activism, social policy, and public polemics, these professors' classroom inculcation of eugenics doctrine was also powerful. A Minneapolis neighbor of mine observed that her mother firmly believed for most of her life that blacks were an inferior race, and justified her belief by saying, quote, "She knew it was true because her university anthropology professor, Jenks, had told her," end quote. Jenks often lectured on eugenics in his classroom using visual aids, such as this chart, which delineated his version of human evolution and development. Now, as you can see here, according to Jenks, humans break off from apes in the late Oligocene, Neanderthals here, split from that branch in the late Pliocene, the branch of humans that leads to present types here, split from Negroes, Negroids, Australoids, Mongoloids, and American Indians in the early Pleistocene. Present types only include what Jenks would recognize as the white races, Alpine, Mediterranean, and Nordic. What becomes apparent from the notes that accompany this chart is that Jenks wrote non-Europeans out of the active line of human evolution altogether. American Indians, Mongoloids, Australoids, Negroids, and Negroes are clustered off to the left, cast as evolutionary diversions and questionable Homo sapiens. While anthropologists like Franz Boas will work to broaden the discipline's perspective, men like Jenks himself maintained his commitments to the end of his life. As late as 1951, 13 years after his retirement, his comments in the foreword of his dead wife's memoir still insist on racial theories of behavior and declare the superiority of old stock Americans over new immigrants, praising pure breeding as the way that they had consolidated their racial virtues. While Jenks taught eugenics in anthropology, it is the efforts of another American Eugenics Society's member on campus that would ensure that every incoming freshman would get at least basic training in theoretical eugenics as part of their freshman orientation course. John Black Johnston, created a discourse that emphasized the natural national qualities of old stock Americans beset by an invasion of immigrants and racial others, and he enacted policy measures to try to, quote, rebuild the university dikes, end quotes, against that flood. He was also a committed eugenicist, devoted to transmitting the principles of biological management for the purpose of national salvation and ultimately the possibility of racial and national perfection. John Black Johnston was born in Bell Center, Ohio, 1868, to a ministerial family. He graduated from the University of Michigan in 1893 and stayed on at Michigan for 6 years as an instructor and assistant until he received his PhD in 1899. His early work centered on the morphology and evolution of the forebrain, and he established himself as one of the founders of the American School of Comparative Neurology. He arrived in Minnesota in 1907 as an assistant professor of anatomy of the nervous system. In 1908, was made associate professor of comparative neurology, and in 1909 was promoted to full professor. By 1923, he had published 45 scientific papers, A Guide to Embryology, and his book, The Nervous System of Vertebrates. In 1914, Johnston was appointed the Dean of the College of Science, Literature, and Arts, a position he held until his retirement in 1937. He served as a noted progressive educational administrator throughout his tenure. He chaired the American Council of Education's Committee on Educational Testing, and he shaped entrance examination procedures for colleges and universities throughout the United States. As a progressive educational reformer, he continued his prolific publication rate. Before retiring, he published 37 educational papers and 3 additional books. Johnston sought to maintain what he saw as a traditional racial, ethnic, gender hierarchy in society. He doubted the value of the new immigrant ethnics arriving at the university. For Johnston, the practice of education had strayed by seeking to enforce a flawed vision of equality. To him, education should be about encouraging natural levels of difference to make the best use of natural hierarchy of ability. University education had focused too long, he believed, on achieving an equality of outcome. Johnston wanted to turn the focus of education to the development of a meritocratic inequality based on biological endowments. Each student should receive the level and degree that they had the heredity for, and no more. He thought that offering the same education to all comers was worse than folly. It was cruel and wasteful. Johnston endorsed inequality as compatible with freedom, but also suggested that educational reform should be based on terms of merit rather than social connections. Society's errors in classification, often mistaking wealth for merit, must be repaired, and a new system installed to determine and enforce the correct categorization of people. A well-taught student of human nature would recognize their position in the natural hierarchy and learn to sublimate their individuation to the good of the social whole. Johnston, to this purpose, consolidated eugenics education on the Minneapolis campus when he achieved his major goal of curricular reform. In 1924, he implemented a year-long orientation course for incoming freshmen as part of a redesigned freshman curriculum. The course was split into 2 sections, Man in Nature for the first term and Man in Society for the second. The required texts for the first term meant that the first 3 books that every freshman bought for their University of Minnesota career were Whipple's How to Study Effectively, Seward's Note-Taking, and Popenoe and Johnson's Applied Eugenics. In other words, the curriculum for the first semester of college encompassed how to read and with whom to breed. The specific lessons in the course's first half indicate that genetics was taught as part of eugenics, not the other way around. The Man in Nature lessons portrayed human hierarchy as a natural evolutionary phenomenon cited in human development and suggested the duty and desirability of civilized man's intentional manipulation of genetic inheritance through eugenics. Like most other eugenicists, Johnson seems to have been uncomfortable with new forms of female social autonomy, and in particular, the new woman and companionate forms of romantic marriage. For Johnston, reproductive choices were too important to be left to the whims of sentimentalists who believed in love at first sight or guided themselves by sexual passion alone. He was convinced that such beliefs resulted from a recent surge of propaganda from novelists and dramatists, especially those of European origin. To him, society plainly had the right and need to control the actions of individuals, even in such a private realm as domestic marital relations. Like other eugenicists, Johnston regarded a farm upbringing as the best way of training youth to reproduce race responsibly. He opined that manipulated yet natural processes of breeding livestock impressed youth with a practical attitude toward reproduction that should carry over to the selection of their own mates. He said, a boy, quote, who since the age of 8 or 10 has seen with his own eyes and understood the inheritance of characteristics in domestic animals, will not be captivated by a feeble-minded girl because she has a pretty face and dances divinely, end quote. Johnson operated in good company with his correlation between sexual immorality and inherited imbecility. Other prominent social commentators such as Paul Popenoe, Charles Davenport would make the same link. Alish Herdlichka, the head of anthropology at the Smithsonian, maintained that the, quote, adult female imbecile is almost as a rule more or less a sexual libertine, end quote. All of these men would resolutely maintain this belief even in the face of contradictory imperial data. And as a quick note, the classification of intelligence and physical disability and the various equations between measured intelligence, gender, sexual preference, and moral fitness are issues that I just don't have time to get into today, though I wish I did. But as you can see in some of these examples, there are networks of assumptions beyond race that determine and influence who is determined to be fit to reproduce. Johnson collapsed political reform and economic reorganization into biology and advocated the managed biological evolution of the race as the cure for social problems. Like Nachtrieb, Hayes, and Jenks, Johnston relied on metaphors of cleanliness, declension, redemption, and the fear of body and social defilement. His prescriptions that students' responsibilities to the state extended to the participation in evolution of a desired race presages our next subjects, who had a more explicit command in telling his students to go forth and out-multiply. The second dean I want to look at, who worked to instantiate eugenic thought on a curricular and an institutional level at the University of Minnesota, was Elias Potter Lyon, dean of the medical school. Elias Potter Lyon was born on a farm near Hillsdale, Michigan, 1867, earned a B.S. from Hillsdale College, 1891, and a B.A. in 1892, received his Ph.D. in physiology from the University of Chicago in 1897, was brought to Minnesota by University President George Vincent in 1913, and served as the dean of the University of Minnesota Medical School until his retirement in 1936. Johnston's leadership is credited with creating the modern medical school in Minnesota, and during his tenure as dean, the university medical school dramatically increased its national reputation and prestige. He was a pioneer in medical education at the graduate level. He integrated the medical school more fully with the rest of the university, and he was one of the first in the nation to create a full-time medical faculty. He was influential in curriculum development, and he established the relationship between the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. Lyon was a reformer who advocated a new type of medical curriculum, one flexible enough to take into account students' varying rates of learning and interest in different aspects of medicine, economic situations, and maturity. Lyon argued against the mechanical character of contemporary entrance requirements, claiming that they were insufficient to determine candidates' true ability for medicine. Like other people I have discussed, Lyon wanted to improve and expand access to education, but he operated with flawed assumptions. They were grounded in an absolute belief in hierarchy of biologically based differences among individual people, among genders and races of people, and such assumptions often emerged in his rhetoric. All of Lyon's discourses about reforming the medical curriculum, opening up possibilities, increasing opportunities, assumed that the faculty and student body was white and male. And even though he worked to ensure broader access to students, he was convinced that any student's ability was innate and fixed. To Lyon, heredity was the most important part of education. He said that, quote, "Education does not make brains. It merely develops their possibilities. Brains are bred, like shorthorn cattle or Percheron horses, from men of brains as shorthorn from shorthorns or Percheron from Percherons." Lyon avowed, quote, "Personally, I would prefer an ounce of heredity to 10,000 pounds of opportunity." Lyon's rhetoric demonstrated an anxiety common among his peers. Manifest destiny had pretty much manifested itself all the way to the coast. By 1912, all of the states but Alaska and Hawaii had been annexed into the U.S. Young men had gone as far west as they could, and the Horace Greeley imperative was replaced by a sense that the conquest of the landscape was complete. The resultant declension in the forward movement of American progress became a widespread national theme. By this model, modern social institutions, such as homes for the disabled, settlement houses, other forms of charity, were actively damaging. Such programs were misguided accommodations, preserving the unfit who, in the state of nature or as frontier pioneers, would have been bred out, thereby improving the race. The imperative claim was that the knowledge of the hereditary mechanism gained through the technological and intellectual advances of Western civilization must be put into practice in order to break the cycle of decline that marked all previous historical civilization. As Lyon would put it, "Let those who must act on this matter consider what would happen to Minnesota if it did not adopt measures for the production of better strains of cattle, hogs, wheat, and corn. Let them turn these thoughts to the most important crop at all, the man crop." Like his Percheron example on selecting students, Lyon here deploys the familiar agricultural metaphor, drawing authority from seemingly objective forces in much the same way. This agricultural metaphor had material consequences when it was applied to policy. Lyon justified the medical school's exclusion of African-American nursing students by comparing the university to an orange grove. Just as oranges would not grow in Minnesota's northern climate, so African-American students would not do well in Minnesota's university. The fact that there were already plenty of African Americans living in the state and attending the university didn't seem to matter. Lyon actually practiced direct eugenic advocacy with his students in his biology classes. In a course he taught in 1936, his lecture on reproduction encompassed the practice of birth control and its racially dysgenic implications. He then went on to exhort his students to breed, saying, "May this class, insofar as they have a reasonable heredity, reproduce their kind. May they steadfastly refuse to trade the privilege of parenthood for the perishable satisfactions of the easy life." End quote. Lyon insisted on the scientific objectivity of the undoubted tendency to race degeneration, and advocated eugenic sterilization both politically and as part of the medical curriculum. by urging his selected and fortunate students to engage in positive eugenics on the one hand and supporting negative eugenics measures on the other, Lyon enacted a special and powerful relationship between the university and eugenics. In a parody of trite valedictory rhetoric, Lyon told his students, quote, "You are the future," end quote. He meant it literally and specifically. By virtue of their superior inheritance, evidenced by their college success, Lyon students deserved to reproduce and had a duty to limit the reproduction of the less fit, who were obvious by their absence from the university classroom. My final figure is the generally acknowledged leader of the eugenics movement at the university and in greater Minnesota, Charles Fremont Dyte, the top gentleman here. While no talk on eugenics in Minnesota would be complete without him, I hope that I have already demonstrated that he was far from the only eugenicist in the state. Although Dyte has now become the best known eugenicist in Minnesota, he joined the eugenics movement later than all of the previous people I've already mentioned. He made up for in devotion and energy what he had lacked in promptness. Dyte helped form the Minnesota Eugenics Society and quickly became its public spokesperson and leader. He corresponded with leading national eugenicists such as Charles Davenport, Madison Grant, and Paul Popenoe. He was a member of the American Eugenics Society and served on its Committee of Public Education. Dyte was born in Mercer, Pennsylvania, 1856, and earned his degree in medicine from the University of Michigan in 1879. He came to Minnesota to teach medicine at Hamline University in 1899. Hamline's medical school was assimilated by the University of Minnesota in 1913, and Dyte continued to teach pharmacology for the University of Medical School until his retirement in 1933. Dyte's zeal and model for reform originated in his involvement with municipal activism. As a municipal alderman, his proudest political achievement was the passage of legislation to ensure the purity of the city's milk supply. His eugenic work in Minnesota centered around the efforts to pass sterilization legislation. He spearheaded the successful passage of the 1925 bill to sterilize residents of the Minnesota School for the Feeble-Minded and worked for the rest of his life trying to broaden that bill's provisions to include the possible forced sterilization of the unfit who were outside state institutions. In 1927, Dyte and University President Lotus Kaufman arranged for Dyte's estate to endow an institute at the university whose purpose was to promote race betterment, teach eugenics, and research human heredity. By the time of his death in 1938, Dyte had published over 300 newspaper articles on eugenics, delivered several series of radio lectures on the topics of human heredity, the social unfit, and the sterilization of the criminal and feeble-minded. In addition, he spoke to countless public gatherings on this topic and was well received by his audiences, who often asked him to return. These venues varied widely, from the Motherhood Protection Association on Calhoun Lake to the science section of the Minnesota Educational Association at their state convention to the Saturday Lunch Club. And that is where this photograph comes from. The Saturday Lunch Club, of which Dyte himself was a member, was a particularly influential club and group of citizens in Minneapolis. Its other members included local business leaders, judges, and practically every Minneapolis politician, whether current, former, or aspiring. The Saturday Lunch Club members represented the leaders of Minneapolis society and social institutions, and Dyte moved easily among this local political elite. This series of photos from the Minneapolis paper shows the influence of the club and Dyte's place in it. The photos from a lunch club event show that Dyte is well known enough in the community, ranking sufficiently to be singled out, along with, in order, Lotus Kaufman, Superior Court John P. Devaney and his wife, and Minnesota Governor Floyd B. Olson, down here. Clustered here on one strip are the man who would influence the passage of Minnesota's eugenic sterilization, the man who would determine the university's role in sterilization, and the officers who would uphold it and enforce it as social policy. Dyte's first eugenic tract, entitled Human Thoroughbreds, Why Not?, details his case for the necessity of eugenic measures. The bold is his. Widespread inferiority threatened. At this time, a situation is threatened where mental inferiority will dominate throughout the whole of the United States. This has greatly lowered the average of American citizenship. We will never recover from it except by the use of eugenic measures. The Canadian thistle and other wild plants will multiply on soil where they are introduced and will choke out useful growths. The admission of undesirable immigrants and the earlier importation of Negroes as slaves have been the two great errors committed by this republic. The results are here, and the long periods of national repentance for these mistakes is at hand. As a nation sows, so shall it also reap. Dyte's writing is unclear about exactly how he envisioned the role of the African American population in the United States. Like nearly all eugenicists, he used the word race to refer to a wide variety of ethnic distinctions. On the one hand, in Human Thoroughbreds, Dyte did call the importation of African slaves one of the great errors committed by the Republic. However, in other venues, it seems he was willing to allow African Americans continued existence in the United States, but was insistent on preventing admixture. Like other progressive eugenicists, Dyte viewed the presence of African American people in the U.S. more as an explicit indication of the adverse consequences of unrestrained greed and avarice. Dyte's fear of dysgenic pollution were not limited to former slaves and their descendants. In a letter published in the national journal Eugenics, Dyte laments the potential danger of Mexican agricultural workers in the Mississippi Valley states. He argues that, quote, the low grade of mentality, end quote, of the Mexican workers and the danger that such a growing population might interbreed with Americans, thus polluting the nation's germplasm, justified the expansion of eugenic sterilization legislation in Minnesota to enable the sterilization of any feeble-minded Mexican, quotes, workers who were at large in society and not confined to institutions. Eugenics, as we can see in Dyte's work, scientized, rationalized, and naturalized extant social prejudices and inequalities with regards to race. Dyte's rhetoric in its cultural context clearly manifested and supported racial ideologies of hierarchy and segregation. Its scientific overlay and popularization through radio, print, and dissemination through the school systems made it a powerful force in the creation and reification of racial separation and inequity. Perhaps part of the explanation for the persistence of eugenic thought and acceptance of systems of biologically based hierarchy is the way that such systems offered objective-seeming physical classifications and verifications and simplified social problems from structural inequities into individual problems based on bad genes. These simplifications were then magnified in visual representations. Dyte himself drew and collected numerous representations of good and bad bodies to use in his advocacy. For example, for an article, Only the Fit Should Procreate, Dyte made this sketch to accompany the article on eugenics. Inferiority here is marked upon the body and linked explicitly to character, with figures like Haggerty, the murderer, and Judas Jr., by the shape of the forebrain and racialized characteristics. When juxtaposed with the almost Star Trek-like depiction of Daniel Webster, criminality and imbecility are clearly phenotypical as well as genotypical characteristics resulting from biological failings grounded in nature itself. The middle panel appeals to the viewer's visual common sense and understanding of evolutionary hierarchy by posing the question, which would you choose for your advisor? Offering a choice between a Daniel Webster-esque bulging cranium or a much smaller head that stretches back from the brow ridge in an almost flat plane. Dyte's career and his political success at yoking eugenic ideas with larger municipal and social management projects places him firmly in line with the international eugenic movement. Dyte's use of biology and the body is a fascinating condemnation of inequalities in his social order. His influence, connections, and commitments to human perfectibility speak to the atmosphere in which Minnesota elites operated. At the same time, even the most idealistic egalitarian eugenicists participated in reinscribing a particular biosocial hierarchy as natural, and the consequences were severe, precisely for those people who were in most need of advocacy, such as the poor, women, racial and sexual others, and the disabled. Recognizing the popularity of eugenics among such a broad base of elites in Minnesota generally and the university specifically is vital to any understanding of the phenomenon. The fundamental faith in essential categories of race and gender and even ethnicity as biologically based evinced an almost Platonic-like faith that such categories were transcendent and allowed eugenicists to feel and know the truth of their assertions in spite of the messiness of social reality in front of their very eyes. Advocates believed eugenic theory to be valid because by grafting manipulatability onto a long-established assumed hierarchy of biology, it offered the promise of rationally directed social reform anchored in easy common sense that endorsed the uncontested biological supremacy of the reformers themselves. It is tempting to personalize this story, to look at these six men as agents of regressive practice. The evidence, I would encourage you to think, is otherwise. Nothing that these men did was the least bit remarkable for their era. Many were significantly modern and progressive, and historical documents suggest that these men were genuinely innovative, caring, and careful educators. It's equally tempting to excuse what went on as with a few waves of the wings of Angel of History, to see this as a benighted period that we have now transcended. Here in the 21st century, we are operating under a paradigm which suggests that a humanistic education is the answer to racism in our society. My work is not so optimistic. We must see Dyte and his contemporaries in ourselves. We too live inside a cultural system, and that system is a product of the system that they created. While the social system has changed over time, the legacy of obsessions with human hierarchy and oppressive conceptions of normality and deviance still remain as part of the fundamental fabric of our own society and continue to shape our own behavior, ideas, and analysis. Moreover, the aspects of eugenic thought that served to develop eugenics into a full-blown social practice did not die with the repeal of sterilization legislation. Rather, many of the necessary components for the society of sterilization remain active components in much of our current social discourse, especially as that discourse addresses issues of race, gender, sexuality, normality, and deviance. Thank you very much for your time.
Any questions? To me, one of the things that's striking is, well, there's two things that are striking. One is that this kind of history I haven't heard resumed frequently at the university, and it may be that nobody else has just dug into the archives and done that, which I think that's also true. But secondly, there's a particularly model aspect about the nature of the movement from a contemporary point of view, and specifically the emphasis on interdisciplinarity. In other words, it was a movement that brought together and bonded fields, and in that way, it had a much greater power. And we're currently in a social moment also with other issues such as genomics and other things, which are bringing a lot of reflection across disciplines, whether sociology, genetics, medical applications, prenatal diagnostics, and the like. And would you comment on modernity, so to speak, or perhaps postmodernity with the issue of interdisciplinarity on that?
That's a very interesting question. As the chair of the Master's Liberal Studies program at Empire State, which is based in interdisciplinarity, the last thing I want to record is an objection to interdisciplinarity, lest my dean see it and I no longer have a job. It is a fascinating piece. I think what we are looking at in eugenics, however, is perhaps a dialectic of interdisciplinarity and disciplinization. There is indeed a powerful sort of cross-fertilization between biology, economics, anthropology, medicine, that all contribute to the practice and ideology of eugenics. But at the same time, when you look at some of these individuals, like particularly Jenks, or perhaps even Frank Bruno of the sociology department, you also see the opposite tendency in eugenics, and in particular the study of race, and that is the narrowing and disciplinization, the creating and justification for particular new and growing disciplines of social science. Anthropology becomes justified, creating itself as a separate discipline by its specific role in researching and developing race. You know, the holy grail of anthropology is to understand racial difference and human hierarchy in a certain way. So that there is an interesting tension at the beginning of this century between the interdisciplinary cooperation that creates this social movement, but also, conversely, the way that that social movement justifies the creation of disciplinization and specialized and professional knowledge. You can see that in a certain degree with Nachtribe, who uses his university advocacy to stump for eugenics, but also eugenics serves as a way to communicate to the public that the university is worth funding and has a special role in society. I will have to think about the current state of affairs more. I think we're actually sort of in the same boat. There are moves towards interdisciplinarity, but then it seems to me that sometimes as funding tightens in education, those moves towards interdisciplinary pull right back into the core of the discipline. And that perhaps I think there's a constant tension in U.S. higher education, at least through the last century, between these poles of sort of interdisciplinary and discipline work. And that didn't exactly answer your question, but it's the best I can do at the moment.
So with all of this movement for eugenics, what did the personal lives of these folks look like? Trying to put it all in perspective here. So were they married? Did they have children? Did they walk the talk?
It's a very interesting question. All of these gentlemen are married. Their personal lives are the personal lives of the bourgeois white middle class of the 1910s. It's an amazingly tight professional scientific academic community. Johnston writes to sort of new university professors, by the way, I have a cabin on Cass Lake. You should get one too, so that we can all hang out together in the summer. And that, there's a certain pressure there that isn't entirely generous. You know, the deans get together at Dean Lyon's cabin in Prescott, Wisconsin, and write schoolboy Oxfordian doggerel poetry to each other in their guest books. I mean, it's an incredibly tight, homogeneous, collegial community. Now, the irony, when you say, do they have children? Do they walk the walk? This is, I think, one of the interesting things of the cadre of powerful eugenics advocates. Many of them don't. Eugenics serves as many of them are the surrogate parents of the nation. Johnston is childless. Jenks has one son, but who dies at 14. Lyon, Dean Lyon, is also childless. Hayes has three children by two marriages. Dight, I believe, is childless. I think when you gather up all of the folks I look at, according to their eugenic advocacy, they should have about 22 children, and they actually have about 11.
Thank you for your work. Did in the process, did you find anyone that made any kind of written critique of this? I mean, were there any vocal sort of opponents of this writing in any kind of setting? Certainly probably not within university settings.
There are, I mean, there is certainly opposition. You know, I mean, my work really focused on trying to explore what's the cultural common sense that enables people to believe this. You know, because it looks so, many of the things that come out look so strange to us now. My work did not focus in particular on opposition, but there are certainly movements of opposition in the larger state. Blanche LeDoux, who runs the Board of Control, is a staunch opponent of Dyte and makes it her life duty to prevent the expansion of the 1925 sterilization law. There are religious leaders who write opposition to it, even as there are religious leaders who support it. Reverend Philip Osgood, rector of St. Mark's Church, actually wins the American Eugenic Society's competition for the best eugenic sermon, which is published in the National Magazine. It's called The Refiner's Fire, which he gives, you know, in St. Mark's Episcopal Church here in Minneapolis. There is a cultural of opposition. The university tends to be on the positive side. I don't find a lot of significant opposition at the university. There are oppositions to the university's specific role. Dean Lyon wants the medical school to take over sterilization, and the regents are unwilling to let the medical school be the actual disciplinary police arm that does the sterilization, they say, because the university shouldn't have a police function. There are oppositions to sort of specific measures, but to the sort of overall common, every schoolboy knows sense that this stuff is just sort of true, it is rare, at least in the archives I read through. And I would like to thank the doctoral dissertation fellowship, you know, here at the university, that allowed me to spend a year in dusty archives reading through the letters of these gentlemen.
So exploring the children of these men, did the children rise to great heights or not?
You know, I actually don't know anything about their children. I hadn't thought of that before, but it's actually a rather interesting commentary. These are the sort of typical men of their time. In their correspondence back and forth, they write about their summer vacations, their camping trips, but not very often about their wives and children. Other than I know that Jenks's son dies at 14 by falling through the ice, and that's sort of a major moment when faculty write him letters of condolence. These gentlemen, I don't know much about their children, so I'm afraid I can't answer the question on these six individuals' children specifically. Somebody else's project.
So there's a pair of questions from listeners on the internet. The first one writes, "The glorification of the farmer is fascinating. To what extent was this sort of rhetoric tailored to the agricultural states? Did the rhetorical climate here differ detectably from the eugenics discourse among Eastern establishment blue bloods, the questioner's own words? And another questioner tags on to the end of that, also from the American South, did it differ here from the eugenics discourse in the American South?
The agricultural rhetoric of the American eugenics movement predominates throughout the American eugenics movement. My focus is primarily before World War II. And if we look at the states that pass initial sterilization legislation, they are not Eastern and they are not Southern. The first state to pass sterilization is Indiana. Between Indiana in 1907 to the U.S. entry into World War I, 19 state legislatures pass sterilization laws, all of which are in the North and West. It is not in the South. There is sterilization legislation that gets passed in the South. It's a different kind of phenomenon than what we see here, and the early sterilization movement is primarily a North and Western movement.
Three decades after all but one state repealed sterilization laws, what are the most lasting vestiges of these men's work?
I mean, I think that what I would try to emphasize is that these men's work, these men's naturalizations of human hierarchy, of natural human hierarchy, you know, really fundamentally continue to plague us at some kind of very visceral, common sense kind of way. That there are ways, again, that their vision of what the nation is, I think, continues to resonate through our kind of social and political vocabulary. And it ties back to the agricultural question in a certain way, that our vision of the nation is still fundamentally shaped by the idea that the United States is, you know, is white, that the United States should be a pure nation. That I think that these men left us a legacy in which we still tend to value purity and harmony over plurality and interesting social conflict. You know, I am a long resident of the Phillips neighborhood in Minneapolis and a proud resident of the Phillips neighborhood in Minneapolis, and living in and being active in the community politics in which it's hard to become more plural in Minneapolis, was a vibrant place to live. And my suburban friends would think, how can you live in that place because it's so dirty? And eventually I heard it's so dirty so often that I began to think about dyte and purity and milk and race, and I began to think dirty perhaps is a metaphor for a different kind of social messiness. We still have an ideology of the white, pure national body, and we don't see the Phillips neighborhood with vibrant immigration, racial admixture, plurality, diversity as what is truly American. And to me, I think that is one of the most harmful legacies of the kind of political program and creation that these men put forward, is our limited vision of what we believe America is and can be.
My question is sort of along the same lines. These people had some influence and power through about the middle of the 30s, and I came to the university in 1960. I don't remember that type of influence. What changed it, or did it change, or what social phenomenon made it change, if it did?
Begin to link into sort of some of the powerful questions that historians try to engage. There is change and there is continuity here. From the construction of the Pioneer Men's Dormitory, note the men's dormitory is Pioneer, they create a building called International House in the late 30s to house African American students born in the U.S. It is specifically forbidden to house students who are born outside the U.S. or white students. In fact, they close International House down when they find a white student and Japanese student living there. White students live in Pioneer Hall. African American students live in International House. With the arrival of World War II, the idea that segregation is natural, patriotic, the best way to run society, becomes associated with fascist Germany. And you have an incredibly powerful social movement and student movement that attacks International House and the administration for segregating the dormitories. They say a segregated house is a Hitler house. You find that this kind of resonation, this resonance moves down and throughout the sort of university common sense. And by 1943, they give up on segregated dormitories. They begin to try to re-envision a racially pluralistic university, so that the women's dormitories integrated in 1943, and the dean of women in 1945 can write, "We've always had integrated dormitories." And I think in some respect has got, you know, is almost good faith at that. She's so reorient, you know, tries to reorient, re-believe. There is certainly an aspect of World War II that functions to change this kind of vision, this kind of 19th century Republican nationalism, the virtuous republic. The ideology of republicanism, not the party of republicanism here. World War II, I think, is a fundamental change. And it's after World War II that historians will begin to call racial activism the period of Second Reconstruction, because it opens up new potential for social intervention. At the same time, I think there is work being done that looks at post-World War II genetics and genetic counseling and draws some consistency between the two. But that work is still being done.
I wanted to ask you, within the rhetoric of genetics and, you know, growing people and growing men as crop, was there ever any discussion of hybrid vigor, of crossbreeding? Or was this itself a scientific development of post-World War II?
Oh, this is one of the fun things that, you know, I just didn't have time for. Thank you for that question. As my dear friend says, these guys are breeding poodles, not vigor, you know, in many respects. Hybrid vigor goes quite a ways back in the scientific vocabulary. People know about hybrid vigor when these people are writing about breeding true. And it's an interesting sort of controversy in the dialogue, and there is eventually a kind of compromise and consensus that eugenicists arrive at. And it becomes sort of the eugenic doctrine up into World War II, that we will recognize the phenomenon of hybrid vigor as applied to humans, because we can see in the United States the creation of the best strain of humanity as the old stock Americans, British, Germans, some Scandinavians, brought their good Teutonic blood to the U.S. And they talk about the Teutonic germ of freedom. You know, that it is that this ideology of freedom and democracy we have is literally in the blood of the Teutonic peoples. And that these crossings of close racial strains, the British, German, Scandinavian, maybe the French, create hybrid vigor. I'm sorry. You develop a really perverse sense of humor when you spend 10 years reading this stuff. So please recognize that there are times I'm speaking with irony in their voice, and don't put these words on me. That when you interbreed between close racial strains, hybrid vigor, like the Yankee stock, is evidenced, you know, and we can see that in the old stock, you know. However, radical crossings, which they use, invariably bring out the worst traits. So that is particularly applied to what we would now think of as interracial, you know, and it's a problematic concept, but, you know, particularly African white mixing is going to be disastrous because the product of such a radical crossing is inferior and doubly inferior. So that the race problem in the United States is usually explained as always the problem of the miscegenated, of the mixed race, because they are born with the ambition of the white race and the ability of the black race.
Go
forth and spend your life's work studying this stuff, because there's, you know, another dissertation to be written there. It's deeply amazing stuff. And it's immensely complex, the kind of labyrinth justifications by which the rationality of racial amalgamation is determined. You know, and you know, my favorite is Albert Ernest Jenks, who does an ethnic census of Minneapolis to study interracial marriages and how fecund they are, and finds that intraracial marriage is almost always more fertile. There are more children when people breed intraracially than interracially. But he's talking about when a racially French man breeds with a racially French woman, they have more children than if that racially French man breeds with a racially German woman. So he's actually doing this fecundity study with the French race, the German race, the English race, the Scandinavian race, the Irish race, the Italian race. Now, interestingly, he does find a couple of exceptions to this law, which are that the Irish, whenever the Irish marry another racial group, they raise the fecundity of that ethnic group. And if Swedes marry each other, the fecundity is depressed.
Without getting too much into German history, I was just wondering if you had a brief comment on how American eugenic thought didn't get so extreme.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. The Germans, you know, we pass eugenic sterilization long before the Germans do. It's Paul Popenoe and Gosney in California who create the model sterilization legislation that the Germans model their 1933 and 35 laws off of. You know, I'm really not a German historian. While there are fundamental similarities, there are fundamental differences. And we were not fascist. While we live in a society that practices some kinds of racial ideologies of exclusionary citizenship, we're not the fascist state. It's an interesting question, and that's about as close to it as I think I can get. I don't know if that answers your question, addresses it. I mean, there must be more to it, but to me, that's just a fairly straightforward piece. We do practice racial hierarchy, racial ideologies, but we're not the same. We do not adopt the same kind of corporatist social model of fascism.
One element that may be of interest, we'll have just one more short question, short answer, was that in the 1942 American Journal of Psychiatry, there was a euthanasia debate about whether or not persons that were considered incurably insane should be euthanized in American institutions. And there was an accompanying editorial from the journal, and it was more toward the arguments of those that were saying that would perhaps be a good policy in the United States. So I think what you talk about in terms of the political context and the potencies which took place in Germany, in fact, some of those same impulses were present here in the United States, but the political opportunity wasn't here. And that was due to complex reasons.
And, you know, in my work, none of these men, you know, and no one that I, you know, and I've spent a lot of years reading this stuff, euthanasia is not at issue. Positive eugenics, yes, encourage, you know, create a social system in which farm folks will breed and outbreed their hired help. You know, that's the critical aspect. The farm owner needs to outbreed the hired help. Positive eugenics, you know, negative eugenics, sterilization, euthanasia, just not an issue. I mean, not an issue in terms of the progressive impulse of municipal reform.
Okay, one last question. And while you're getting ready to leave, if you could scribble your evaluations, that would be much appreciated. Thank you.
This was sort of dealt with his question over there, but it seems like our interdisciplinarity that they brought to their eugenics movement, the more power they gained as they mixed medicine and agriculture and government. How did they have such narrowness of mind to realize that wouldn't be the case with human race, like mixing cultures and bringing in different points of view would provide that same increase in power, I guess.
What I've tried to demonstrate sort of implicitly here by putting up their little bios, by putting up, you know, some photos of them, is what a narrow band of individuals these are. You know, I mean, you have men, college-educated, a small band of college-educated, white, Anglo-Protestant, a little bit of German immigrant influence in the family, all of whom are college educated at a time when 2% of the college population, 2% of the population go to college, so a very small band, and, you know, primarily from small towns, from professional families, and this actually speaks to the scientific community of the entire United States. If you read David F. Noble's work on technology, Nation by Design, you can see that what he describes as the scientific community of engineers and scientific professionals are a very small band that very naturally put that small band at the top of the pinnacle. You know, in a certain respect, the hope, as the scientific community enlarges, our hope is that a broader participation in science and in sciences by people with more cultural influences, with a different cultural background, gives us a better science.
Well, with that, I thank you all for your participation and to Mark Soderstrom for the presentation.
Thank you.